Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair with Lynn Curtis of the club's member-led arts forum, and I'm the organizer for today's program. Our speaker today is Sarah Thornton, a sociologist of art and a regular contributor to The Economist. Her bestseller, 7 Days in the Art World, in 2008, explored the cutthroat yet glamorous cultural phenomenon of the contemporary art market with its precious ecosystem of art dealers, collectors, curators, and critics. And so today she'll report the stories resulting from worldwide interviews about the question, what is an artist? From her latest book, which is 33 Artists in 3 Acts. Thornton writes that those narratives, quote, demarcate the ideological border that differentiates artists from non-artists or real artists from unimpressive ones. Artists interviewed include Ai Weiwei, Jeff Koons, Lena and Grace Dunham, and Cindy Sherman, among others, many others from 20 countries on 5 continents. So here's a context for today's meeting to keep in mind. Sarah has written that politics, kinship, and craft also happen to embrace some of the most important things in life: caring about your influence on the world, connecting meaningfully with others, and working hard to create something worthwhile. She's a masterful storyteller, as you'll discover and hear, who has contributed numerous times to lots of different media, television and radio. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Sarah Thornton.
Thank you very much, Anne, and thank you all for coming. I'm going to show slides, and you can see the cover of the book here, which is done by Luke Butler, who is gracing us with his presence in the back row. It's a work called Self-Portrait with 4 of 33 Artists, and Luke has fashioned himself in a blue suit there as a kind of business artist. Some interpret that figure as a kind of Jeff Koonsian character. And clearly, the competition for attention and recognition in the art world is cutthroat. And I'm very grateful to Luke for crafting and conceptualizing that wonderful cover. So it's a challenge to distill 5 years of research into 100,000 words of a book. And again, a challenge to boil that down into 40 minutes. But I'm going to do my best, and I'm just going to start with two anecdotes, really, related to different works. On the left is a work by Tammy Ray Carland, who teaches at the California College of the Arts. It's titled I'm Dying Up Here, and it's a self-portrait. You can see a lot of the ancillary expectations that befall artists nowadays, the pressure to speak, to perform, to entertain, the absurdity of the pink towel suggests the battle for recognition, for one's credibility, for being taken seriously in a particular vein. One of the arguments in the book is that an artist's work is not just the isolated objects they may produce or the things we find within frames or on pedestals, but very much the entire way they play their game. So I look back to my sociological background there. My version of the word work is very sociological. And although I studied art history and understand the work in the narrower sense, I think if you want to understand the way artists move through the world today and attain greater levels of success, then you need to understand all the work they do. On the right is a work by Katie Noland, who's another artist in the book. I was very pleased to have the opportunity to interview her. I'm not entirely certain when the last time she gave an interview was, but I think it might have been 24 years ago, in 1990. I have to triple fact check that one. This is a work called Oswald from 1989, and it actually gave her the title of being the most expensive living woman artist. One of the things that intrigues me about her is that she's one of the few artists who's evoked her rights under the Visual Artists' Rights Act of 1990. And this act grants artists the right to, quote, prevent the use of their name in association with distorted, mutilated, or modified work that could prejudice their honor or reputation. Basically, what happened is a work of hers called Cowboys Milking was coming up for auction at Sotheby's with an estimate of between $200,000 and $300,000. The corners of this, this is actually a sculpture, so it's kind of silk screen on metal. And there was a part of the sculpture that was bent and slightly deformed, and she felt obliged to renounce her authorship of the work. And overnight, the work went from being worth an estimated $300,000 to being worth absolutely nothing at all. So for me, it's just very much illustrative of the power of an artist's name within the market, of course, but I think that it's not just the market that insists on artist brands, but the entire art world. The solo show is the dominant exhibition format in contemporary museums. These solo shows generally obtain greater footfall than group shows. The monograph is the dominant form of publication, and even in the popular press, the profile, the isolated profile is key. So, you know, there's authorship is arguably one of the many things that differentiates art from craft. The history of craft is a history of objects made by anonymous artisans, whereas the history of art is very much a history of things made by people with names. Another one of the arguments in the book is that artists don't just make art, they create and preserve myths that give their work clout. I do feel somewhat at odds with the mainstream of the art world in saying something like this, because the dominant ideology is that the work inside the frame is the only thing that's appropriate to discuss. And when I was researching 7 Days in the Art World and this book, 33 Artists in Three Acts, I was met with quite a bit of resistance, actually, to this broader view. Interestingly, principally from curators who were not so keen that I asked the question, what is an artist, it would seem. I have some good curator friends who were incredibly supportive and went with me, but then also some like very negative reactions to like, why would you want to write that book? And that, as an ethnographer, is always a good indication that the book really does need to be written if you get, such emotional and negative reactions to a question seemingly as innocent. There are also art critics who can be quite self-righteous about not being distracted by the behavior or talk of artists. I'm not sure how they can keep artist talk out of their heads. So often it's the case that artworks enter the world engulfed in discourse, even if it's just the gallery press release telling you that the way the work was made. There's things that are included and things that are excluded. I think that despite this resistance, the fact is that individual inanimate objects are easily ignored unless they are clustered in a branded oeuvre, an oeuvre with a backstory. And, you know, the artist and his or her authorship is integral to understanding contemporary art today. Here are just a couple of examples of different games artists play with artistic myths, consciously and unconsciously, because I think it's not always a conscious thing. Yayoi Kusama is the oldest artist in the book. She's in her mid-80s, and I think that her life and her myth hark back to earlier generations, the kind of crazy genius myth. I think it's actually harder for younger artists to occupy that role credibly today, partly because we've have these bifurcated social worlds. There's the outsider art world and the insider art world. My book is very much about professional artists working on the inside for the most part, although outsider art comes up as a topic in parts of the book. On the right-hand side is a work by Rashid Johnson, and I must find the title because it's very long and I can never quite get it right, so if you just bear with me. This work is called Self-Portrait as the Professor of Astronomy, Miscegenation, and Critical Theory at the New Negro Escapist and Athletic Club Center for Graduate Studies. And, you know, he's comically underlining the strange range of knowledges that artists often have, and comically underlining the artist is genius myth, and but also intriguingly evoking his own family background. Rashid is in the kinship part of the book, and we spend quite a bit of time talking about family, and certain parts of his work look like ancestor worship. But as he describes it, his own family background is very much bifurcated between an extremely well-educated bourgeois part of the family. His grandfather was one of the first graduates of Harvard. His brother went to Harvard with Obama. And then on his father's side, as he puts it, being a Johnson from Tennessee. And so, you know, I think here is kind of through a self-portraiture, a kind of very self-conscious enactment of the things that he finds credible and the things that might disturb his credibility, all kind of bundled up into a very humorous package. So, next thought. You know, so related to my arguments that an artist's work is the entire way they play their game, and that artists don't just make art but engender myths that give extra magic, kick, energy, authority, and believability to their work, is the idea that being an artist has ironically become a craft. And I think that this started in the Renaissance, but it intensified in 1917 with Marcel Duchamp. While 19th century painters faced credibility issues, Duchamp made belief a central artistic concern. In 1917, when he declared an upended urinal to be an artwork titled Fountain, he was claiming a godlike power for all artists to designate anything they chose as art. That actually puts a lot of pressure on artists to command authority of different kinds, and it creates a situation where there are no objective measurements of quality, or it contributes to that situation, and so ambitious artists need to establish their own standards of excellence. Here we have La Belle Haleine by Duchamp on the left-hand side. He enlisted the support of Man Ray as his assistant on this particular work because Man Ray took the photo of him in drag, which appears in exactly that spot that you might expect a brand to appear, a kind of Uncle Ben's rice kind of positioning of the artist. My argument is that when he rejected the handmade in favor of the ready-made, Duchamp began crafting identities as well as ideas, and that this is no accident. Oftentimes, people like to cut off different parts of Duchamp's oeuvre and myths, and even there are artists in the book, such as Christian Markley, who, you know, loves Duchamp, but like hates that bit about Duchamp where he's dressing up, you know, and playing games with his identity. It's interesting. Different parts of the art world, you know, subscribe to different parts of his oeuvre. But he certainly did spend a lot of time making works as Rose Selavi, which is the character we see here, but also presenting himself as a confidence man or a con man in a Most Wanted poster, which became the poster ad for his first retrospective, which took place down in Pasadena in the early 60s. On the right-hand side, we've got Marina Abramović in the midst of performing The Artist is Present. I think the title kind of says a lot, perhaps it all, about the locus of the work. During this performance piece in New York, she sat all day, every day for 3 months in the atrium of the museum, engaging in silent one-to-one encounters with members of the public. I spoke to her after this performance when she was really quite exhausted from this incredible marathon, and was very intrigued when she distinguished between her low self and her high self. Her high self equated with her performing self, a self which is actually somewhat stripped of gender and sexuality. But I was intrigued and couldn't quite get to the bottom of what she meant by her low self, and continued to prod her. And she eventually explained that her low self was, quote, full of contradictions and things that you're ashamed of. And I thought, okay, tell me more. And she said, well, you know, I love fashion. In the 1970s, that made you a bad artist. And I think it's noteworthy, because a love of cars and strip bars has never had a commensurate effect on the credibility of male artists. And it is very intriguing, actually, the whole relationship between an art and fashion, which still can be used against women artists in subtle and not so subtle ways. One of the myths out there is that anybody can be an artist. Oops. Sorry, I've got to be careful where I lean here. I think it's actually very difficult to become an artist. It's not just a job, but an identity whose authority is hard won. And I always ask my interviewees, at what point did you feel confident declaring yourself an artist? Because it comes in very different ways for different artists. And having a BA from art school or an MFA from art school is not enough. So different people have different responses. One conversation I had with Frances Elise, a Belgian who lives in Mexico City, was that he felt that his artistic identity was very much linked to being in Mexico, and had tried to live abroad and then come back to Mexico. And as he explained it to me, he said, I became an artist here. That has a lot to do with my dependence on this place. I don't have a past in the art field in Europe. What is the location that took you seriously? And I think artists often displace themselves, usually to cities like New York, LA, or Berlin, but certainly from like small towns to big towns, and that emigration helps them escape the burdens of their cultural heritage and, very importantly, embrace identities that they might otherwise feel inhibited in assuming. And sometimes just getting away from the parents can be important because they may be the last people to accept their child is really an artist, you know. Although there's a lot of contrary evidence, too. Interestingly, a lot of the artists in the book have artist parents, and I'm quite interested in the extent to which, it's a family business. On the right-hand side is Martha Rosler in the midst of her cult classic Semiotics of the Kitchen from 1975. When this video was reviewed in Art Forum, it was suggested that, being in the kitchen and the kind of content of the work was evidence that she was not a, quote, serious artist. And Rosler speaks quite eloquently about how feminist issues in the 1970s were often considered too trivial to be worthy of art, and warns that seriousness is now swiveled, and in her opinion, it is often the case that certain subject matters can be too grave for art, As she put it, quote, today art is supposed to be ambiguous or playful. So when a work deals with something like war or homelessness, it can step outside the bounds of what is considered art. Just so you, I'm not making this up. Here's a map that acts as a frontispiece to the book, which shows the locations of the scenes, and also, I'm not sure if you can see on this monitor, the shaded countries are the countries of origins of the artists in the book. And so between 2009 and 2013, I interviewed 130 artists, some of them multiple times, and I also observed them. And for me, an interview is never enough. I need to kind of contrast that with some kind of careful observation of them at work in their space, interacting with others. It was very, very difficult to whittle the book down to a manageable size, and my criteria for including artists in the book were both that of a casting director and a curator. The decisions were curatorial insofar as their work needed to be relevant to me and to a large extent my themes. There is a bias in the book towards artists who are kind of interrogating the role of the artist, and then on the other side, with regard to casting, it was important that the artist be willing to tackle my questions. One of my favorite artists, celebrated Eminence Grise, when I asked him, what is an artist? He said, an artist makes art. And he just wasn't really interested in engaging with my questions, which was hugely disappointing because I think there were a lot of interesting things going on in his work that were relevant to the book. But my feeling was he'd kind of evolved a very formalist discourse in the late 70s, early 80s, and had kind of stuck with it. And so it was hugely disappointing, and, you know, he's on the cutting room floor. There are many celebrated and famous artists who didn't make it into the book. And in the end, the artists are from 14 countries on 5 continents, and the mean year of birth is 1960. The other thing I ended up doing was cutting out the very emergent end, because what I found was that artists with 20 years experience being an artist were giving me richer answers to the questions I was asking. And I did my PhD in the sociology of youth, and I really felt like exploring emergent artists' issues had to be a separate book, and I would have had to have sacrificed the global perspective of the book, and I wouldn't have been able to do the cross-cultural comparisons that I wanted to do if I was also dealing with like broad age demographics. And finally, although there's no way to be representative in this field, I don't think, because any artist worth his or her salt has customized the role so specifically to themselves that they're not a type, actually. They only really represent themselves. I did try to capture some of the diversity within the field in terms of artists who perceive themselves as academics, some who are much more, working as entertainers, idealists versus materialists, narcissists versus altruists, and loners versus collaborators. As Anne mentioned, the book is divided into 3 acts, and it was only after interviewing my first 100 artists that I decided what the themes would be. I guess that's part of my training as an ethnographer. I didn't want to have a blueprint and go out and seek. My question, what is an artist, was really my, and some attendant questions about, you know, what myths do they reject and feel like they're enlivening and things like that. I had a very broad cluster of questions that I went out with, and these three themes did very much emerge from the transcripts. Just to hop, skip, and jump very quickly through giving you a snapshot of each act. Act One, Politics, explores artists' ethics, their attitudes to power and responsibility, paying particular attention to human rights and freedom of speech. It's there as well that I deal with gay politics, touch upon gender and race, although those come up again in each act. On the left, we have Wangeshi Mutu, who perceives her work very much to be in about the politics of beauty. And one of the things that intrigued me about her is that she's a Kenyan-born artist based in Brooklyn, and that in her mother tongue, Kikuyu, there is no word for artist. The closest term is magician, which is interesting. And as she says, magician, or, quote, a person who uses objects and imbues them with meaning and power, which I think is a very good definition of a ready-made. When I asked her what kind of artist she felt she was, she described herself as a tattletale, or the person who divulges the family secrets. And this really captured my imagination, because I feel like that is somewhat my relationship to the art world. In the middle section, the issues, you know, Act Two, Kinship, investigates artists' relationships with their peers, muses, and supporters, with an eye on competition, collaboration, and ultimately love. Cindy Sherman is the extreme loner in this part of the book. Not even her assistant gets to watch her making the work. She chooses her costumes, does all her makeup, does the lighting, takes the picture, does all the post-production herself. And from a kinship point of view, clearly has kind of cloned a family in art. And one of the other artists in this part of the book is Laurie Simmons, with whom she's had a long-standing friendship, and Sherman once described Simmons as her artist soulmate. Then finally, Act Three, Craft, explores artists' skills and all aspects of making artworks, from conception through execution to marketing strategies, and includes this notion of being an artist, being a craft. One of the few craftsmen in the strict sense of the word included in this part of the book is Grayson Perry. He became famous in Britain when he won the Turner Prize in 2003 because when he went up to accept his award on national television, he said, "It's about time a transvestite potter has won the Turner Prize." His win was exceedingly controversial within the London art world, interestingly, and I don't think it's because he's a transvestite. I did a lot of research with artists at the time, and there seemed still to be a kind of snobbery around his use of the decorative arts. He very much sticks to the media of the decorative arts, so he works in ceramics, textiles, clothing, tapestries, etchings, and various kind of printmaking, and there was some shock that a potter could win the Turner Prize. Perry, for his part, sees the split between art and craft as one that involves class. And in his term, I'll quote him, he says, "Whereas a craftsman is a worker, a painter is often just an incredible craftsman in a suit jacket." And he believes that despite its high status, most painting today is arguably just craft. And I'll quote him again. He says, "Painting is locked into a tradition. It's very difficult to be original unless you can find a micro-niche, and then it's difficult to step out of your niche because the territory on either side is already inhabited by another artist with his own micro-niche." So one of the things that's a little bit different about the book, and because I did have ambitions to make it more than a series of profiles, is that I compare and contrast artists and juxtapose them in ways that I hope is thought-provoking. And so the two recurring characters in Act One Politics are Ai Weiwei and Jeff Koons. They are, within 2 years of each other, They both use ready-mades. They're both very influenced by Marcel Duchamp. They both use the media like no one else, probably, in the history of art. And but Ai Weiwei politicizes everything he touches, and Kunz would prefer to depoliticize everything he touches. And so it was, and also there's so much written about Kunz, and it seemed to me that it was funny, when I first mentioned that I was putting Kunz in part of the book called Politics, various art world people go, Kunz has a politics? And of course, everyone has a politics. And one of the powerful things about neoliberalism is its invisibility. And I hope that by contrasting them and interrogating the very slippery Kunz repeatedly, that a politics emerges. And certainly the thing that intrigues me between these two images by the two artists is what might be perceived as their attitudes towards freedom of speech, because Ai Weiwei clearly is a staunch advocate to the point that he is willing to go to prison for it. And that particular self-portrait by Kunz shows him to be a young man who knows the power of discretion, who certainly knows not what not to say, for whom self-censorship may come naturally. These are a couple of other artists in this part of the book, Gabriel Orozco and Eugenio Ditborn. Ditborn is a Chilean artist who came of age during the reign of Pinochet, and I was interested to kind of get a compare, the way artists living in non-democracies with no freedom of speech kind of handled the climate in which they were working. So, comparing a right-wing dictatorship like Pinochet to a, so-called dictatorship of the people with Ai Weiwei was interesting to me. The thing that Ditborn did is he created airmail paintings, he made these paintings that could be sent outside the country for exhibition, and he kind of had this life as an artist beyond the borders of his country. And also, amongst the disappeared in his early years as an artist were a lot of artists, and for him, significantly, his psychotherapist. So the disappeared became a kind of theme in his work, one that haunted his work for decades in a kind of unconscious way. So the theme of kinship gives rise to clusters of artists rather than kind of a single pair who are antagonists. And I was very keen to have an artist couple in this part of the book. It took me rather a long time to find the right ones. Carol Dunham and Laurie Simmons are in their 60s now and have been artists for over 40 years. And they, luckily for me, had read 7 Days in the Art World and knew where I was coming from and were very trusting and willing to open up with me and disagree with each other in front of me and things like that. One of my problems was I was very keen to have an artist couple with comparable levels of recognition, and it is so often the case that one artist lives in the shadow of the other. And also I had trouble getting the right kind of access. So one artist couple that I was thinking about working with, they would only be interviewed apart and never together. And intriguingly, another artist couple only wanted to be interviewed together and never apart. Luckily, Tip and Laurie, Tip's nickname is Carol Dunham, Carol Dunham's nickname is Tip. Tip and Laurie were very flexible and open. And I'm very interested in the issue of self-belief, because how can you command the belief of others and accrue of consensus or belief around your work if you don't have immense self-belief? But that's you have to be very open to the interviewing process to kind of start talking about your lack of confidence. Wonderfully, Tip and Laurie did go there, and I'll just read a couple of quotes. When I asked them about their insecurities and anxieties, Simmons said, "When you're younger, you think about eradicating self-doubt. But as you age, you understand that it is part of the rhythm of being an artist. As I get older, I have developed my ability to examine self-doubt in private, to play around with it rather than push it away." Dunham experiences his uncertainty as a strange mixture of self-loathing and megalomania, by contrast. And he says, quote, "Humans set up hierarchies, and we are constantly judging. In the morning, you tell yourself you're a horrible artist. By the afternoon, you might feel like God. By dinner, you're a lesser angel." These are some other artists in the book. In each act, there are artists who don't make a living from their work, and mostly who teach. On the right is a work by William Paujita, who teaches high school in Brooklyn. And on the left, Jennifer Dalton, who has a day job kind of doing clerical work that's not too demanding, so she can keep her mind space for her work. And obviously, I would have had a lot of people to choose from in this category of artists with day job, because, of course, the vast majority of artists do have day jobs. And I chose them because their work was so relevant to my themes of being an artist in this art world. Carol Dunham and Laurie Simmons are recurring characters in Act Two, and they are contrasted with Maurizio Cattelan and his brothers in crime, a couple of Italian curators called Francesco Bonomi and Massimiliano Gioni, and the other recurring character in this part of the book is Cindy Sherman. So that's that cluster. And in the course of interviewing Tip and Laurie, their daughter Lena Dunham, who had, when I first started interviewing them, was a graduate of Oberlin working on an independent film, eventually shot out of a cannon, got an HBO contract for a program called Girls, won Golden Globes, now has her own memoir, and her sister I decided to include in the book because one of the key themes here was competition and how to maintain your self-esteem when your partner or when someone else is having a glorious moment and you're having like a difficult time in the studio, and all of a sudden Lena's career became relevant to her parents. And there's some poignant moments in the book, I think they're poignant, you know, where Laurie's talking about all of a sudden being Lena Dunham's mom, you know, as if she didn't have a public persona herself. So that leads me to Act Three, Craft, where the foils are Damien Hirst and my auntie Hirst, Andrea Fraser. And Hirst, you know, one of the most famous artists in the world, has done things like Beautiful Inside My Head Forever, which was a sale at Sotheby's where he took over 200 works straight out of the studio, put them on the auction block, and made $200 million in 24 hours. Some people saw this act as a conceptual, artistic act, and celebrated it as a moment in which an artist took control of his market like no other artist had done before. And then the other half of the people I interviewed thought he'd ceased to be an artist. And of course, any moment when an artist ceases to be an artist is of interest to me because that's defining the terrain. This moment here in his underwear seems to be a moment of midlife crisis. A midlife crisis that really rolled over into his work in a big way, because my feeling is he lost faith in the Duchampian project. He lost faith in the work he'd been doing for over 20 years, his sharks and formaldehyde, his medicine cabinets, his pill cabinets. He did paintings as well, but probably was most innovative as a sculptor using ready-made materials, and took up painting, do-it-yourself painting, and said, I mean, as he says to me in the book, not only was he inspired by Francis Bacon, but also Rembrandt, which is a tough thing to emulate when you return to painting in your 40s. He is very much contrasted with someone who's also a spectacular risk taker, Andrea Fraser, who's very much the anti-Hearst in the book. She's a feminist performance artist who teaches at UCLA, and here you can see her in the midst of performing Official Welcome, which is a performance she did at SF MoMA a few years ago. And in a moment, she's going to take off that bra and knickers and perform Hearst fully naked. And it's a very funny work that unpacks a lot of the myths of being an artist. And she, you know, is the pinup on the cover of the book and is very much emblematic of the book for me. She says a lot of things that I need someone to say in ways far more eloquent than I could say them. And she's very well read in psychoanalysis and talks very interestingly about the fantasies of being an artist, including fantasies of omnipotence, which she sees as coming from childhood, and certainly makes sense in a Duchampian world where artists have this divine power to designate something as art. So I'm going to skip ahead just in the interest of time because I'm keen for questions and they run a very tight ship here at the Commonwealth Club. Just a couple more artists who are in the book, two filmmakers in this section called Craft, one of whom, Christian Markley, works with ready-made film, and Isaac Julian, who works with, who makes his own images, and the complex craft relationships they have with the people they work with. With Isaac Julian, we're on the set of Playtime, and I'm, you know, on set with 35 craftspeople, everyone from the DOP to the gaffer to the costume designer, and, you know, so craft is not lost within contemporary art. It is just the case that the artist, him or herself, is not necessarily manually doing it, and that does seem to be a major stumbling block for people outside the art world who often have problems with people who don't make their own work. But I think the thing to remember is that, you know, architects today, artists today are much like architects. You know, we don't expect them to be laying every brick. Or film directors, you know, why would they be expected to sew the buttons on the costumes? That kind of thing. So my final slide. So artists don't just make art, they create and preserve myths that give their work clout, and this is a job, not just a job, but an identity, which requires immense authority. And sometimes maintaining that authority is absolutely exhausting. And artists decide to either give it up or moderate it in some way. And so on the left-hand side, there's a work by Mauricio Catalan. He was part of the inspiration behind the book. He had very kindly given me an illustration for the cover of the British edition of 7 Days in the Art World, and we'd had quite a bit of correspondence over the years, and then I finally met him in the summer of 2009 and found it very intriguing, the way he was playing his game and the different kinds of artist identities that he invoked. And right from the beginning of the book, he was stressed and exhausted with what he saw as walking on a tightrope of credibility and myth-making. And I'll just quote you a quote from him from early in that act. He says, "We are constantly working on a tightrope. The more I go ahead, the higher the tightrope. If you fall from 3 meters up, you break your legs. But from 30 meters, all your problems are solved at once." And then, funnily enough, you know, a few years later, over the course of Act Two, he actually does sling up all his works and hangs his works like kind of like a mass slaughter in the atrium of the Guggenheim, and very spectacularly retires as an artist. Of course, a lot of people retire from being an artist, but not on the eve of the retrospective. And oops. Sorry, I just want to, I'm going to finish with a quote from the book. On the right-hand side is a work called Gay Marriage by Elm Green and Dragset. And this is an artistic duo who have worked together for many years. They see themselves as each half an artist or a two-headed monster. And but despite their long-standing collaboration, don't agree on the on whether they're even artists or not, and on the term. And so here they are in the midst of a little disagreement in front of me. Elm Green says, I don't have the taste in my mouth or the smell in my nose of being an artist. I'm a cultural producer. Dragset flicks his eyes to the sky and then looks to me for support. I'm an artist. I wouldn't call myself anything else, just as I'm gay and I wouldn't call myself queer. I remember very well making the decision to accept myself as an artist. I had my 30th birthday in New York City, where we had a residency. Up until that point, I had felt embarrassed. Then I thought, fuck it, I can be an artist just as much as anyone else. And then Elm Green, with a mischievous glint in his eye, says, these identity groups are so last century. You are a gay artist in the 20th century. I would also say that we are far too busy to be artists. We make artworks, do a theatrical performance, publish a book, design a t-shirt, create a show, so many things. We are like small mice avoiding being trapped or cornered. Our work is not about universal truths. All we do is tell small lies. On that note, I welcome any questions.
Thank you so much. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Arts Forum speaker Sarah Thornton talking about her latest work, 33 Artists in 3 Acts. I'll start and then raise your hand if you have a question. So since Ai Weiwei is here with us, I will cross the water a little bit, and has this remarkable show, which he can't see because he's not permitted to be here, could you comment a little bit more about your response to him and his apparent ability to not censor himself?
I always like it when an artist never wants to go off the record, and Ai Weiwei is certainly one of those. When I asked him what is an artist, he gives like 3 interviews a day, and he's got quick answers for all sorts of things. He actually didn't automatically have an answer, which is not surprising. It's not an everyday question. And he started telling me the story of his father, who had trained as a painter and then given up painting when in prison because he couldn't get access to materials, and became a poet. So he was in prison during the Chiang Kai-shek government, and then later his father fell afoul of the Maoists and was declared a rightist and exiled to the remote regions of China, where he had to clean latrines and do other forms of menial labor. And so Ai Weiwei kind of winds up this anecdote saying, well, you know, his father had always been an enemy of the state, and that was the perception he'd always had. So I said to him, so is being an artist being an enemy of the state? And he paused, and he said, being an artist is being an enemy of general sensibilities, which is a very poetic response, and also one that we associate with like a romantic notion with the avant-garde. And it's interesting that he can credibly hold that position in China, because there is no freedom of speech and no democracy. And you know, in America, the hard thing is, like, where are the general sensibilities? And in such a pluralistic culture, you can be accepted by being outrageous in many different ways. So I think, you know, for a lot of us, the Ai Weiwei does live a myth that can no longer be lived here in a way that's very compelling. I think that, you know, one of the reasons politics is a theme in the book is because, you know, are you an artist or an activist? Are you an artist or a politician? Are you an artist or a didactic illustrator is one of the boundary lines that demarcates artists from non-artists within the ideology of the art world. And when Ai Weiwei opened his show at the Hirshhorn, I was gobsmacked that Roberta Smith of the New York Times and Peter Sheldahl of the New Yorker, both of whom I love reading, kind of brought up the issue of what is an artist in their reviews, which is very unusual, because they were really puzzled and troubled and couldn't kind of deal with his work aesthetically, and were kind of dismissing him as being just a politician. Other questions? How about front row and then back row? Okay. Because let's go where the mic is now.
I thought you had retired from being an art critic and an art commentator. You want to talk about that just a little bit?
Of course. I have never called myself an art critic, actually. I see myself as an investigative reporter, as an ethnographer, as like an arts writer, I guess, in the general sense. But I avoid the term critic, partly, well, for many, many different reasons. I kind of feel like what I like or don't like is not that interesting. And actually, I think perhaps it's a question that comes up too much in the art world. You know, something you hate can be way more interesting than something you like. And more important. When I finished 7 Days in the Art World, there were two questions that there were two things I was really interested in, the art market and artists. And so I wrote a lot for The Economist, and will actually go back to writing for The Economist in January, although not writing about the market specifically, writing general museum pieces and stuff like that. And I definitely did burn out about writing about the art market. And wrote a piece that went viral, kind of, which was actually didn't mean it to be prescriptive at all. I just wanted to clear my head so I could write this book and focus on my other interest in the thing I'd been researching over that 4-year period. So I've never been a critic, I guess.
Maybe you answered my question. I think that I've been an artist my whole life, and I think that the market really shapes the artist, and maybe you're just burned out by it. But when you look at the Sotheby's auction now, and you look at the power of Gagosian and his 11 galleries, and you know it really seems driven in that direction. But maybe you're just tired of that. But you spoke exclusively about the artist.
Well, the market is a theme in Act 3 of the book, Craft. I mean, partly because Hearst is a key figure, and he's so much stands in for the market artist nowadays. It was a very self-conscious decision to leave an exploration of the market to the final act. Kunz is in the beginning of the book, and you can't escape the market when you're talking about him, but I try to put him through a different kind of filter because the market speaks very loudly, and prices shout out other meanings. And I have friends who are not very involved in the contemporary art world who think that contemporary art has become a luxury good for rich people and it's not of interest to them. And that is one of the reasons why I chose these topics of politics, kinship of craft, because I think they're actually much more universal themes that can engage people who aren't interested in prices. I think it's impossible not to talk about the market when talking about being an artist today, and I think young artists in particular at art school really feel like there's this big monster looming over them, and I think it needs to be discussed in art school, and pretending it doesn't exist is not helpful. They need strategies, be they strategies like Andrea Fraser, which totally circumvent the market or whatever. So that's a lot of answers in a lot of different directions. Absolutely. Gabriel Orozco is one of the other artists who kind of influenced the shape of the book in a way, but more belatedly, he was really interested in the project. I think his wife has anthropology background. He was like intrigued by the way I was going about things and was keen to tackle my questions. And is spectacularly articulate and dynamic in his ability to talk about all sorts of different things. He's the one artist that appears in Act 1 and Act 3. The other recurring artists appear within an act. One of the things he said about the book, because he read it in early draft form, is that, he's talking about the artist in the book. He said, we all appear in our underwear. At least some of us get to keep our socks on. There's a lot to say about him. I mean, he is, he really does. I think he's a spectacular artist in a lot of different ways. I mean, he understands how to play the game. He's very canny. He won't show. He did one show with White Cube in London and then decided he didn't want to show with them again because he didn't want to be tarnished by the reputation of Damien Hirst. You know what I mean? Like, these are actually real decisions that artists make all the time because reputation management is so important to them. You know, he also founded, you know, basically inspired the founding of his own gallery in Mexico City because there wasn't a gallery he wanted to operate with there. But that's a very different strategy than someone like Hearst, you know, to found a gallery that could support artists he believed in his hometown. So Curry Manzuto, he even came up with the name of Curry Manzuto. It's the two, the couple who are the dealers who run that gallery. But he was, you know, basically gave them the training and inspiration to found the gallery. There's so much to say about him. I don't know. I mean, he's got great lines, you know, talking about politics. He's very articulate because he was the son of a communist muralist. And you know, he grew up in a highly politicized environment, and he actually is someone who doesn't want to be burdened with being having to have a political position on everything and being on the evening news, you know. By the same token, ethics are really important to him. And so, yes, I mean, he's a, you can tell I'm a fan. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, oh, yeah.
Hi.
We maybe have time just for these two. If, yeah?
I really love your three sections of your book, the politics, kinship, and craft, and how you organized your book.
Thank you.
And I'm interested in the artists that fall outside the margins and who aren't in the art world.
Yes.
And so, folk art, intuitive art, sometimes finds place there, but I'm curious and interested in where like the projectature of capitalism and kind of the art world and what your interest in how you see that fitting in.
I mean, as a sociologist, I had to kind of isolate one social world, and of course the insider art world, as I call it, in contrast to outsider art, which is its own world, and folk art, which is another world, has its own... there's a lot of conflict and diversity and a lot of micro ecosystems and all that kind of thing, but there you can actually talk about a global, you know, set of assumptions and values around conceptual contemporary art. And so it... you know, outsider art comes into the book principally in Act Two, Kinship, because a lot of insider artists are interested in outsider art. And so Maurizio Catalan and Carol Dunham and Laurie Simmons actually collect outsider art. And the Act Two, Kinship starts in Venice and ends in Venice, and it ends at Massimiliano Gioni's biennial, which includes a lot of outsider artists in amongst the professional art world endorsed artists. And one of the things that intrigues me about the two worlds is they have very different operating expectations. So a lot of the things that are expected and valued of outsider art are actually not de rigueur within insider art. For example, outsider art is expected to be authentic, self-expressive, emotional, you know, free associational. There's a whole sort of a whole kind of cluster of things that are valued within outsider art, and within insider art, that is seen as like very passé, something that was abandoned with abstract expressionism, and not de rigueur at all. And so it intrigues me that it's almost like artists have a nostalgia. To integrate that into their lives, knowing that actually they can't get away with it in the same way. Folk art doesn't come up so much, I guess. I mean, there's a lot of different work being made by living artists today, and the patch that I'm exploring is very much art made, with the influence of conceptualism, and in the legacy of Marcel Duchamp is very much the terrain that I explore. Could we do one last one?
Okay. Yes, of the material on the cutting room floor, what was the hardest to leave behind?
There are about 10 artists in particular who were really hard. And then the last three, even up to the last, you know, and I wouldn't want to divulge their names, just, you know, a curator of a group show doesn't list the names of the people who didn't get into the group show, you know. There are four people in this book that I interviewed for 7 days in the art world, but didn't include there. So Damien Hirst, Isaac Julian, and Grayson Perry, and also Massimiliano Joni were people I interviewed for 7 days, did not appear there, and appear in this book. So my hope is that I'll be able to write another one.
And soon. We look forward to your next work. Thank you so much to Sarah Thornton for her wonderful talk here today. I really learned a lot. And in the last page or so of the book, Andrea Fraser says, the artist is saying, remember me. And certainly Sarah is letting us remember her. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 110th year. Its 110th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.